Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
There is a theory that great men have large heads and prominent features. Think of Charles de Gaulle and his nose, LBJ and his ears, FDR and his jaw. And by this standard, if no other, Richard Nixon had reached greatness. His head was enormous. His jowls and ski jump nose were just as cartoonists had always portrayed them. His eyes dark and penetrating. Most striking of all was his voice, a deep, rumbling basso profundo, rather like an avalanche in the distance.
That's from an essay that Michael Korda wrote for The New Yorker in 1994. Korda was, among other accomplishments and positions, for many years, the editor-in-chief of Simon & Schuster, and Richard Nixon was one of his celebrity authors. Korda's relationship with Nixon was productive, if not exactly warm. Nixon didn't tend to like media types, understandably, or people he considered intellectuals. But in 1989, Korda was invited to a dinner in Saddle River, New Jersey, where the president and Mrs. Nixon lived most of the years after their exile from Washington. That's the night that Korda recounts in his essay, Nixon, Mine Host. Here's Dylan Baker reading from Michael Korda's story, with Greg Stir as Richard Nixon.
Within a mile or so of a New Jersey commercial strip full of mini malls and service stations, Nixon's house was tucked away as secretly as Shangri-La. Behind high, dense growths of trees and hedges, it was impossible for any casual intruder to find, rather like any number of cul-de-sacs in Bel Air, but without palm trees. Nixon's staff had presented me with careful instructions on how to reach the house, but it seemed a little puzzled that I was driving myself. Their puzzlement became clear as I pulled up before the entrance. A row of limousines to one side made it evident that Nixon's guests tended to be driven by chauffeurs. I had driven my silver Porsche. The courtyard was a blacktop space big enough for a good-sized motel. The security people at the door seemed uncertain what to make of the car, though whether because it was frivolous or foreign, I wasn't sure. Inside, I found most of my fellow guests milling about in the entrance hall, looking suitably solemn. I recognized Robert Abplanalp, a large, jovial-looking man who had been in the limelight as a Nixon backer and personal friend during Watergate. There was the CEO of Archer Daniels Midland, an assistant secretary of state, and a former U.S. representative to NATO. There were also three Chinese gentlemen, all with the bland, inscrutable faces of professional diplomats. The senior of them was Han Xu, China's departing ambassador. There were no women present. It was to be a stag dinner. Nixon appeared at the top of the stairs at exactly the moment we had been summoned for. He descended halfway, stretched out his arms just as he used to do when he was campaigning, with a broad smile.
Gentlemen, the good news is the bar is open.
As I was shortly to discover, drinks in the Nixon household were not to be taken or even held lightly. They were served in immense, heavy tumblers, and every time a guest took a sip, Nixon, who had an eagle eye as a host, would attract the butler's attention.
You'd better freshen up Mr. Korda's drink.
I ordered one of his famous daiquiris made with almost no sugar, the recipe for which was said to be one of his more closely guarded secrets. The president claimed to make the best daiquiri ever, and I can report that it lived up to expectations. What I was not prepared for was the odd formality that he imposed on himself and his guests. There was no conversation as such. One guest had just returned that day from Paris, where the Cambodian talks were going on. Nixon asked him to give us a report on the subject, which he did, at some length, while we sat and listened. When he was through, Nixon gave us his views on the subject, during which absolute silence reigned, while the butler freshened up our drinks. The three Chinese men, who were presumably accustomed to feigning interest at the interminable meetings of the Communist Party, gave these disquisitions their full, rapt attention, while most of the Americans gently slumbered, arms crossed in front of them, chins resting on their chests. What kept my attention focused was not the subject of Cambodia, but the fact that Nixon was in the habit of referring to himself in the third person, something I had never heard anyone do before, not even members of the British royal family.
"When Nixon was president,"
he'd say, his dark eyes flickering over his guests as if he expected one of us to challenge him.
"When Nixon was president and leader of the free world,"
as if leader of the free world were also an office to which he had been elected. Roused by the announcement that dinner was ready, we filed into the dining room, where the first course proved to be a contribution from Mr. Abplanalp, who had branched out from manufacturer of aerosol valves for spray cans to entrepreneur of smoked fish. While we ate our smoked tuna, smoked trout, and smoked salmon, the real purpose of the dinner became apparent. The massacre of the Chinese student protesters in Tiananmen Square had occurred only 2 months earlier, and Nixon was debating whether he should continue with his plans to revisit China. The former representative and ambassador to NATO, Robert Ellsworth, brought up the key question, the piece de resistance, as it were, which was how America was reacting to Tiananmen Square and whether Nixon should go to Beijing. Han Xu and the other diplomats came to full attention at this. I could not help admiring the way Nixon had managed to get somebody else to raise the question, and the way he gave it careful scrutiny, as if it had caught him by surprise. He knotted his brows.
"I believe that there is more to be gained by going than not. Some people,"
he frowned darkly,
"some people, naysayers, parlor liberals, professional skeptics, would doubtless criticize Nixon. Nixon is used to that. It's never stopped Nixon in the past."
The Chinese nodded.
"Great powers cannot allow their foreign policy to be determined by the scruples or prejudices of the liberal media."
A deeper nod, with a hint of puzzlement from the Chinese, for whom media scruples were surely not a problem.
"The interests and the good relations of two such powers as China and the United States are more important than transitory events. Ordinary Americans like and respect China and are not dismayed by the horror stories."
He leaned close to Han Xu, who continued to eat methodically and with enthusiasm while the translator whispered in his ear.
"When Nixon was president and leader of the free world, we had troubles of our own in the United States. We, too, had so-called student riots, protests, anarchy in the streets of Washington. When you go home, you tell your people that many of us understand. When Nixon was president and leader of the free world, he found that firmness paid. You tell them that."
The Chinese smiled for the first time. Firmness had so far been a hard sell for them in the United States, even in the Bush White House, where running over students with tanks was seen, at the very least, as poor PR for the Beijing regime. Han Xu finished what was on his plate, put his knife and fork down neatly, and raised his glass of red wine, a gift from the President of France, we had been informed, in a gesture of gratitude. Not quite a toast, but by no means casual, either. He whispered something to the translator. "He is grateful for the President's understanding," the translator said. "He will communicate it all home."
"Good."
We withdrew to a somber room with a huge rough stone fireplace. While my fellow guests got down to the serious business of the evening, telling old political war stories from the Nixon campaign and drinking monster stingers, I followed Nixon, who had offered to show the diplomats around the house. Most of the rooms had a certain formal, unlived-in quality, rather like an expensive hotel suite, or, more to the point, the White House. The unlived-in feeling apparently extended to Nixon. At one point, he opened a closet door, apparently thinking that it was the door to his study, then slammed it shut hastily with a muttered oath.
"Son of a bitch."
Like people lost in a museum, we circled aimlessly for some time, admiring the ceremonial gifts on display that Nixon had received from other heads of state. Lucky on the second try, he flung open the door to his study and ushered us in.
"This is where Nixon works."
It was difficult to imagine any work being done in this unused room. It had something of the quality of a stage set furnished with expensive new props. There was not a paper in sight, and the desktop, like everything else in the room, was polished, spotless, and apparently brand new.
"This is the desk at which Nixon wrote all his books."
He patted its shiny leather top affectionately, as if it were a horse. We stood uncomfortably around the empty desk. And then Nixon told Han Xu that he wanted him to have a souvenir of his visit, something which would convey the American spirit.
"There was a man in the 40s and 50s whom Nixon had always respected as a true patriot, a man who made great sacrifices for the truth and had been martyred. That man wrote a book, one of the most important books of the 20th century, a book that every American ought to read, and not just American either. His message is universal."
Nixon bent down and opened the bottom drawer of his big desk and withdrew a copy of Whitaker Chambers' Witness. I was fascinated to see that the drawer was full of hardcover copies of Chambers' book. Had Nixon bought up the entire stock? Briefly, Nixon summed up Chambers' role in the Alger Hiss case, explaining to the three communist bureaucrats the undoing of a communist conspiracy in the United States, and the way the liberal media persecuted all those who had tried to bring the truth to light, Nixon himself not excepted. Han Xu showed every sign of agreement with this view of history, and after Nixon autographed a copy of Witness for him, he clutched it to his bosom as if it were the Holy Grail. We returned to the fireplace, where the atmosphere, fueled with stingers, was getting boisterous. Nixon, I could tell, had had enough of the Chinese by now, and they seemed to have tired of him, too. I took my leave with them. It was a testimony to Nixon's power that he could make his world, the world of exile, seem more real than the world around him, that he could create somehow the illusion that he was still the president, that Watergate had never happened, that the bombing of Cambodia or the shooting of the Kent State students hadn't really mattered, and that Whitaker Chambers was an American hero. Nixon walked us outside to shake hands. He saw the Chinese into their waiting limo, then said good night to me. He looked across the blacktop at my Porsche and studied it carefully.
What the hell is that?
Greg Stir as Richard Nixon and Dylan Baker reading from Michael Korda's essay, Nixon, Mine Host. It was published in The New Yorker in 1994.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.